Yes, Dr. Howland, asked Leslie. I think you're missing a control group that measures the actual effectiveness of your distractors. It's possible that some of them simply aren't noticed. You could test their distractibility simultaneously, or you might swap out the distractor for the target. It was a valid point. It was, in fact, the proper way to do the experiment, and her paper wouldn't be publishable without that possibility satisfied. Alice was sure of it, yet no one else seemed to see it. She looked at everyone, not looking at her. Their body language suggested embarrassment and dread. She reread the data on the screen. That experiment needed an additional control. The fact that she had Alzheimer's didn't mean that she couldn't think analytically. The fact that she had Alzheimer's didn't mean that she didn't know what she was talking about. Okay, thanks, said Leslie. But she didn't take any notes, and she didn't look Alice in the eye, and she didn't seem at all grateful. She had no classes to teach, no grants to write, no new research to conduct, no conferences to attend, and no invited lectures to give. Ever again. She felt like the biggest part of herself, the part she'd praised and polished regularly on its mighty pedestal, had died. And the other, smaller, less admired parts of herself wailed with self-pity and grief, wondering how they would matter at all without it. She looked out her enormous office window and watched the joggers as they traced the winding edges of the Charles. "Will you have time for a run today?" she asked. "Maybe," said John. He looked out the window, too, as he drank his coffee. She wondered what he saw, if his eyes were drawn to the same joggers, or if he saw something entirely different. "I wish we had spent more time together," she said. "What do you mean? We just spent the whole summer together." "No, not the summer. Our whole lives. I've been thinking about it, and I wish we'd spent more time together. Allie, we live together, we work at the same place, we've spent our whole lives together." In the beginning, they did. They lived their lives together, with each other. But over the years, it had changed. They had allowed it to change. She thought about the sabbaticals apart, the division of labor over the kids, the travel, their singular dedication to work. They'd been living next to each other for a long time. "I think we left each other alone for too long." "I don't feel left alone, Allie. I like our lives. I think it's been a good balance between an independence to pursue our own passions and a life together." She thought about his pursuit of his passion, his research, always more extreme than hers. Even when the experiments failed him, when the data weren't consistent, when the hypotheses turned out to be wrong, his love for his passion never wavered. However flawed, even when it kept him up all night tearing his hair out, he loved it. The time, care, attention, and energy he gave to it had always inspired her to work harder at her own research, and she did. "You're not left alone, Allie. I'm right here with you." He looked at his watch, then downed the rest of his coffee. "I've got to run to class." He picked up his bag, tossed his cup in the trash, and went over to her. He bent down, held her head of curly black hair in his hands, and kissed her gently. She looked up at him and pressed her lips into a thin smile, holding back her tears just long enough for him to leave her office. She wished she had been his passion. She sat in her office while her cognition class met without her and watched the shiny traffic creep along Memorial Drive. She sipped her tea. She had the whole day in front of her with nothing to do. Her hip began to vibrate. It was 8 a.m. She removed her BlackBerry from her baby blue bag. "Alice, answer the following questions. 1. What month is it? 2. Where do you live? 3. Where is your office? 4. When is Anna's birthday? 5. How many children do you have? If you have trouble answering any of these, go to the file named Butterfly on your computer and follow the instructions there immediately. September, 34 Poplar Street, Cambridge. William James Hall, room 1002. September 14th, 3. She sipped her tea and watched the shiny traffic creep along Memorial Drive. October 2004. She sat up in bed and wondered what to do. It was dark, still middle of the night. She wasn't confused. She knew she should be sleeping. John lay on his back next to her, snoring. But she couldn't fall asleep. She'd been having a lot of trouble sleeping through the night lately, probably because she was napping a lot during the day. Or was she napping a lot during the day because she wasn't sleeping well at night? She was caught in a vicious cycle, a positive feedback loop, a dizzying ride that she didn't know how to step off. Maybe, if she fought through the urge to nap during the day, she'd sleep through the night and break the pattern. But every day, she felt so exhausted by late afternoon that she always succumbed to a rest on the couch. And the rest always seduced her to sleep. She remembered facing a similar dilemma when her children were around 2 years old. Without an afternoon nap, they turned miserable and uncooperative by the evening. With a nap, they stayed wide awake hours past their usual bedtime. She couldn't remember the solution. With all the pills I'm taking, you'd think at least one would have drowsiness as a side effect. Oh, wait. I have that sleeping pill prescription. She got out of bed and walked downstairs. Although fairly confident it wasn't in there, she emptied her baby blue bag first. Wallet, BlackBerry, cell phone, keys. She opened her wallet. Credit card, bank card, license, Harvard ID, health insurance card, $20, a handful of change. She rifled through the white mushroom bowl where they kept the mail. Light bill, gas bill, phone bill, mortgage statement, something from Harvard, receipts. She opened and emptied the contents of the drawers to the desk and file cabinet in the study. She emptied the magazines and catalogs out of the baskets in the living room. She read a couple of pages from the Week magazine and dog-eared a page in the J. Jill catalog with a cute sweater. She liked it in seafoam blue. She opened the junk drawer. Batteries, a screwdriver, scotch tape, blue tape, glue, keys, a number of chargers, matches, and so much more. This drawer probably hadn't been organized in years. She pulled the drawer completely off its tracks and dumped the entirety of its contents onto the kitchen table. "Allie, what are you doing?" asked John. Startled, she looked up at his bewildered hair and squinting eyes. "I'm looking for..." She looked down at the items jumbled before her on the table. Batteries, a sewing kit, glue, a tape measurer, several chargers, a screwdriver. "I'm looking for something." "Allie, it's after 3. You're making a racket down here. Can you look for it in the morning?" His voice sounded impatient. He didn't like having his sleep disrupted. "Okay." She lay in bed and tried to remember what she'd been looking for. It was dark, still middle of the night. She knew she should be sleeping. John had fallen back to sleep without ceremony and was already snoring. He was a fast sleeper. She used to be, too. But she couldn't fall asleep. She'd been having a lot of trouble sleeping through the night lately, probably because she was napping a lot during the day. Or was she napping a lot during the day because she wasn't sleeping well at night? She was caught in a vicious cycle, a positive feedback loop, a dizzying ride that she didn't know how to step off. "Oh, wait. I have a way to get to sleep. I have those pills from Dr. Moyer. Where did I put them?" She got out of bed and walked downstairs. There were no meetings or seminars today. None of the textbooks, periodicals, or mail in her office interested her. Dan didn't have anything ready for her to read. She had nothing new in her inbox. Lydia's daily email wouldn't come until afternoon. She watched the movement outside her window. Cars zipped around the curves of Memorial Drive, and joggers ran along the curves of the river. The tops of the pine trees swayed in the turbulent fall air. She pulled all of the folders out of the bin marked Howland Reprints from her file cabinet. She'd authored well over 100 published papers. She held the stack of research articles, commentaries, and reviews, her truncated career's worth of thoughts and opinions, in her hands. It was heavy. Her thoughts and opinions carried weight. At least, they used to. She missed her research, thinking about it, talking about it, her own ideas and insights, the elegant art of her science. She put the pile of folders down and selected her From Molecules to Mind textbook from the bookcase. It, too, was heavy. It was her proudest written achievement, her words and ideas blended with John's, creating something together that was unique in this universe, informing and influencing the words and ideas of others. She'd assumed they'd write another someday. She flipped through the pages without being lured in. She didn't feel like reading that either. She checked her watch. She and John were supposed to go for a run at the end of the day. That was way too many hours away. She decided to run home. Their house was only about a mile from her office, and she got there quickly and easily. Now what? She walked into the kitchen to make some tea. She filled the kettle with tap water, placed it back on the stove, and turned the burner knob to high. She went to get a tea bag. The tin container where she kept the tea bags wasn't anywhere on the counter. She opened the cabinet where she kept the coffee mugs. She stared instead at three shelves of plates. She opened the cabinet to the right of that, where she expected to see rows of glasses, but instead it housed bowls and mugs. She took the bowls and mugs out of the cabinet and put them on the counter. Then she removed the plates and placed them next to the bowls and mugs. She opened the next cabinet. Nothing right in there, either. The counter was soon stacked high with plates, bowls, mugs, juice glasses, water glasses, wine glasses, pots, pans, Tupperware, pot holders, dish towels, and silverware. The entire kitchen was inside out. Now where did I have it all before? The tea kettle shrilled, and she couldn't think. She turned the burner knob to off. She heard the front door open. Oh, good. John's home early. John, why did you do this to the kitchen? She hollered. Alice, what are you doing? The woman's voice startled her. Oh, Lauren, you scared me. It was her neighbor who lived across the street. Lauren didn't say anything. I'm sorry, would you like to sit down? I was about to make some tea. Alice? This isn't your kitchen. What? She looked around the room. Black granite countertops, birch cabinets, white tile floor, window over the sink, dishwasher to the right of the sink, double oven. Wait. She didn't have a double oven, did she? Then, for the first time, she noticed the refrigerator. The smoking gun. The collage of pictures stuck with magnets to its door were of Lauren, and Lauren's husband, and Lauren's cat, and babies Alice didn't recognize. Oh, Lauren, look what I did to your kitchen. I'll help you put everything back. That's okay, Alice. Are you all right? No, not really. She wanted to run home to her own kitchen. Couldn't they just forget this happened? Did she really have to have the I have Alzheimer's disease conversation right now? She hated the I have Alzheimer's disease conversation. Alice tried to read Lauren's face. She looked baffled and scared. Her face was thinking, Alice might be crazy. Alice closed her eyes and took a deep breath. I have Alzheimer's disease. She opened her eyes. The look on Lauren's face didn't change. Now, every time she entered the kitchen, she checked the refrigerator, just to be sure. No pictures of Lauren. She was in the right house. In case that didn't remove all doubt, John had written a note in big black letters and stuck it with a magnet to the refrigerator door. Alice, do not go running without me. My cell, 617-555-1122. Anna, 617-555-1123. Tom, 617-555-1124. John had made her promise not to go running without him. She'd sworn she wouldn't and crossed her heart. Of course, she might forget. Her ankle could probably use the time off anyway. She'd rolled it stepping off a curb last week. Her spatial perception was a bit off. Objects sometimes appeared closer or farther, or generally somewhere other than where they actually were. She'd had her eyes checked. Her vision was fine. She had the eyes of a 20-year-old. The problem wasn't with her corneas, lenses, or retinas. The glitch was somewhere in the processing of visual information, somewhere in her occipital cortex, said John. Apparently, she had the eyes of a college student and the occipital cortex of an octogenarian. No running without John. She might get lost or hurt. But lately, there was no running with John either. He'd been traveling a lot, and when he wasn't out of town, he left the house for Harvard early and worked late. By the time he got home, he was always too tired. She hated depending on him to go running, especially since he wasn't dependable. She picked up the phone and dialed the number on the refrigerator. "Hello?" "Are we going for a run today?" she asked. "I don't know, maybe. I'm in a meeting. I'll call you later," said John. "I really need to go for a run." "I'll call you later." "When?" "When I can." "Fine." She hung up the phone, looked out the window, and then down at the running shoes on her feet. She peeled them off and threw them at the wall. She tried to be understanding. He needed to work. But why didn't he understand that she needed to run? If something as simple as regular exercise really did counter the progression of this disease, then she should be running as often as she could. Each time he told her, "Not today," she might be losing more neurons that she could have saved. Dying needlessly faster. John was killing her. She picked up the phone again. "Yes?" asked John, hushed and annoyed. "I want you to promise that we'll run today." "Excuse me for a minute," he said to someone else. "Please, Alice, let me call you after I get out of this meeting." "I need to run today. I don't yet know when my day's going to end." "So?" "This is why I think we should get you a treadmill." "Oh, fuck you," she said, hanging up. She supposed that wasn't very understanding. She flashed to anger a lot lately. Whether this was a symptom of her disease advancing or a justified response, she couldn't say. She didn't want a treadmill. She wanted him. Maybe she shouldn't be so stubborn. Maybe she was killing herself, too. She could always walk somewhere without him. Of course, the somewhere had to be somewhere safe. She could walk to her office. But she didn't want to go to her office. She felt bored, ignored, and alienated in her office. She felt ridiculous there. She didn't belong there anymore. In all the expansive grandeur that was Harvard, there wasn't room there for a cognitive psychology professor with a broken cognitive psyche. She sat in her living room armchair and tried to think of what to do. Nothing meaningful enough came to her. She tried to imagine tomorrow, next week, the coming winter. Nothing meaningful enough came to her. She felt bored, ignored, and alienated in her living room armchair. The late afternoon sun cast strange Tim Burton shadows that slithered and undulated across the floor and up the walls. She watched the shadows dissolve and the room dim. She closed her eyes and fell asleep. Alice stood in their bedroom, naked but for a pair of ankle socks and her safe return bracelet, wrestling and growling at an article of clothing stretched around her head. Like a Martha Graham dance, her battle against the fabric shrouding her head looked like a physical and poetic expression of anguish. She let out a long scream. "What's happening?" asked John, running in. She looked at him with one panicked eye through a round hole in the twisted garment. "I can't do this. I can't figure out how to put on this fucking sports bra. I can't remember how to put on a bra, John. I can't put on my own bra." He went to her and examined her head. That's not a bra, Allie. It's a pair of underwear. She burst into laughter. It's not funny, said John. She laughed harder. Stop it. It's not funny. Look, if you want to go running, you have to hurry up and get dressed. I don't have a lot of time. He left the room, unable to watch her standing there, naked with her underwear on her head, laughing at her own absurd madness. Alice knew that the young woman sitting across from her was her daughter, but she had a disturbing lack of confidence in this knowledge. She knew that she had a daughter named Lydia, but when she looked at the young woman sitting across from her, knowing that she was her daughter Lydia was more academic knowledge than implicit understanding, a fact she agreed to, information she'd been given and accepted as true. She looked at Tom and Anna, also sitting at the table, and she could automatically connect them with the memories she had of her oldest child and her son. She could picture Anna in her wedding gown, in her law school, college, and high school graduation gowns, and in the snow-white nightgown she'd insisted on wearing every day when she was 3. She could remember Tom in his cap and gown, in a cast when he broke his leg skiing, in braces, in his Little League uniform, and in her arms when he was an infant. She could see Lydia's history as well, but somehow this woman sitting across from her wasn't inextricably connected to her memories of her youngest child. This made her uneasy and painfully aware that she was declining, her past becoming unhinged from her present. And how strange that she had no problem identifying the man next to Anna as Anna's husband, Charlie, who had entered their lives only a couple of years ago. She pictured her Alzheimer's as a demon in her head, tearing a reckless and illogical path of destruction, ripping apart the wiring from Lydia now to Lydia then, leaving all the Charlie connections unscathed. The restaurant was crowded and noisy. Voices from other tables competed for Alice's attention, and the music in the background moved in and out of the foreground. Anna's and Lydia's voices sounded the same to her. Everyone used too many pronouns. She struggled to locate who was talking at her table and to follow what was being said. "Honey, you okay?" asked Charlie. "The smells," said Anna. "You want to go outside for a minute?" asked Charlie. "I'll go with her," said Alice. Alice's back tensed as soon as they left the cozy warmth of the restaurant. They'd both forgotten to bring their coats. Anna grabbed Alice's hand and led her away from a circle of young smokers hovering near the door. "Ah, fresh air," said Anna, taking a luxurious breath in and out through her nose. "And quiet," said Alice. "How are you feeling, Mom?" "I'm okay," said Alice. Anna rubbed the back of Alice's hand, the hand she was still holding. "I've been better," she admitted. "Same here," said Anna. "Were you sick like this when you were pregnant with me?" "Uh-huh." "How did you do it?" "You just keep going. It'll stop soon." "And before you know it, the babies will be here," said Anna. "I can't wait." "Me too," Anna said, but her voice didn't carry the same exuberance Alice's did. Her eyes suddenly filled with tears. "Mom, I feel sick all the time, and I'm exhausted, and every time I forget something, I think I'm becoming symptomatic." "Oh, sweetie, you're not. You're just tired." "I know, I know. It's just when I think about you not teaching anymore and everything you're losing." "Don't. This should be an exciting time for you. Please, just think about what we're gaining." Alice squeezed the hand she held and placed her other one gently on Anna's stomach. Anna smiled, but the tears still spilled out of her overwhelmed eyes. "I just don't know how I'm going to handle it all. My job and 2 babies and Charlie. Don't forget about you and Charlie. Keep what you have with him. Keep everything in balance. You and Charlie, your career, your kids, everything you love. Don't take any of the things you love in your life for granted, and you'll do it all. Charlie will help you." "He better," Anna threatened. Alice laughed. Anna wiped her eyes several times with the heels of her hands and blew a long, Lamaze-like breath out through her mouth. Thanks, Mom. I feel better. Good. Back inside the restaurant, they settled into their seats and ate dinner. The young woman across from Alice, her youngest child, Lydia, clanged her empty wine glass with her knife. Mom, we'd like to give you your big gift now. Lydia presented her with a small rectangular package wrapped in gold paper. It must have been big in significance. Alice untaped the paper. Inside were three DVDs. The Howland Kids, Alice and John, and Alice Howland. It's a video memoir for you. The Howland Kids is a collection of interviews of Anna, Tom, and me. I shot them this summer. It's our memories of you and our childhoods and growing up. The one with Dad is of his memories of meeting you and dating and your wedding and vacations and lots of other stuff. There are a couple of really great stories in that one that none of us kids knew about. The third one I haven't made yet. It's an interview of you, of your stories, if you want to do it. I absolutely want to do it. I love it. Thank you. I can't wait to watch them. The waitress brought them coffee, tea, and chocolate cake with a candle in it. They all sang happy birthday. Alice blew out the candle and made a wish. November 2004. The movies that John had bought over the summer now fell into the same unfortunate category as the abandoned books they'd replaced. She could no longer follow the thread of the plot or remember the significance of the characters if they weren't in every scene. She could appreciate small moments, but retained only a general sense of the film after the credits rolled. That movie was funny. If John or Anna watched with her, they would many times roar with laughter, or jump with alarm, or cringe with disgust, reacting in an obvious, visceral way to something that happened, and she wouldn't understand why. She would join in, faking it, trying to protect them from how lost she was. Watching movies made her keenly aware of how lost she was. The DVDs Lydia had made came at just the right time. Each story told by John and the kids ran only a few minutes long, so she could absorb each one, and she didn't have to actively hold the information in any particular story to understand or enjoy the others. She watched them over and over. She didn't remember everything they talked about, but this felt completely normal, for each of her children and John didn't remember all of the details either. And when Lydia asked them all to recount the same event, each remembered it somewhat differently, omitting some parts, exaggerating others, emphasizing their own individual perspectives. Even biographies not saturated with disease were vulnerable to holes and distortions. She could only stomach watching the Alice Howland video once. She used to be so eloquent, so comfortable talking in front of any audience. Now, she overused the word thingy and repeated herself an embarrassing number of times. But she felt grateful to have it. Her memories, reflections, and advice recorded and pinned down, safe from the molecular mayhem of Alzheimer's disease. Her grandchildren would watch it someday and say, "That's Grandma when she could still talk and remember things." She had just finished watching Alice and John. She remained on the couch with a blanket on her lap after the television screen faded to black and listened. The quiet pleased her. She breathed and thought of nothing for several minutes but the sound of the ticking clock on the fireplace mantel. Then, suddenly, the ticking took on meaning, and her eyes popped open. She looked at the hands. 10 minutes until 10 o'clock. Oh my God, what am I still doing here? She threw the blanket onto the floor, crammed her feet into her shoes, ran into the study, and clicked her laptop bag shut. Where's my blue bag? Not on the chair, not on the desk, not in the desk drawers, not in the laptop bag. She jogged up to her bedroom. Not on her bed, not on the night table, not on the dresser, not in the closet, not on the desk. She was standing in the hallway, retracing her whereabouts in her boggled mind, when she saw it hanging on the bathroom doorknob. She unzipped it. Cell phone, BlackBerry, no keys. She always put them in there. Well, that wasn't entirely true. She always meant to put them in there. Sometimes she put them in her desk drawer, the silverware drawer, her underwear drawer, her jewelry box, the mailbox, and any number of pockets. Sometimes she simply left them in the keyhole. She hated to think about how many minutes each day she spent looking for her own misplaced things. She bolted back downstairs to the living room. No keys, but she found her coat on the wing chair. She put it on and shoved her hands in the pockets. Keys. She raced to the front hallway, but then stopped before she could reach the door. It was the strangest thing. There was a large hole in the floor just in front of the door. It spanned the width of the hallway and was about 8 or 9 feet in length, with nothing but the dark basement below it. It was impassable. The front hall floorboards were warped and creaky, and she and John had talked recently about replacing them. Had John hired a contractor? Had someone been here today? She couldn't remember. Whatever the reason, there was no using the front door until the hole was fixed. On her way to the back door, the phone rang. "Hi, Mom. I'll be over around 7 and I'll bring dinner." "Okay," said Alice, a slight rise in her tone. "It's Anna." "I know." "Dad's in New York until tomorrow, remember? I'm sleeping over tonight. I can't get out of work before 6:30, though, so wait for me to eat. Maybe you should write this down on the whiteboard on the fridge." She looked over at the whiteboard. "Do not go running without me." Provoked, she wanted to scream into the phone that she didn't need a babysitter, and she could manage just fine alone in her own house. She breathed instead. "Okay, see you later." She hung up the phone and congratulated herself on still having editorial control over her raw emotions. Someday soon, she wouldn't. She would enjoy seeing Anna, and it would be good not to be alone. She had her coat on and her laptop and baby blue bag slung over her shoulder. She looked out the kitchen window. Windy, damp, gray. Morning, maybe? She didn't feel like going outside, and she didn't feel like sitting in her office. She felt bored, ignored, and alienated in her office. She felt ridiculous there. She didn't belong there anymore. She removed her bags and coat and headed for the study, but a sudden thud and clink made her backtrack to the front hallway. The mail had just been delivered through the slot in the door, and it lay on top of the hole, somehow hovering there. It had to be balancing on an underlying beam or floorboard that she couldn't see. Floating mail. My brain is fried. She retreated into the study and tried to forget about the gravity-defying hole in the front hallway. It was surprisingly difficult. She sat in her study, hugging her knees, staring out the window at the darkened day, waiting for Anna to come over with dinner, waiting for John to return from New York so she could go for a run. She was sitting and waiting. She was sitting and waiting to get worse. She was sick of just sitting and waiting. She was the only person she knew with early-onset Alzheimer's disease at Harvard. She was the only person she knew anywhere with early-onset Alzheimer's. Surely she wasn't the only one anywhere. She needed to find her new colleagues. She needed to inhabit this new world she found herself in, this world of dementia. She typed the words, early-onset Alzheimer's disease, into Google. It pulled up a lot of facts and statistics. There are an estimated 500,000 people in the United States with early-onset Alzheimer's disease. Early onset is defined as Alzheimer's under the age of 65. Symptoms can develop in the 30s and 40s. It pulled up sites with lists of symptoms, genetic risk factors, causes and treatments. It pulled up articles about research and drug discovery. She'd seen all this before. She added the word support to her Google search and hit the return key. She found forums, links, resources, message boards, and chat rooms. for caregivers. Caregiver help topics included visiting the nursing facility, questions about medications, stress relief, dealing with delusions, dealing with night wandering, coping with denial and depression. Caregivers posted questions and answers, commiserating about and troubleshooting issues regarding their 81-year-old mothers, their 74-year-old husbands, and their 85-year-old grandmothers with Alzheimer's disease. What about support for the people with Alzheimer's disease? Where are the other 51-year-olds with dementia? Where are the other people who were in the middle of their careers when this diagnosis ripped their lives right out from under them? She didn't deny that getting Alzheimer's was tragic at any age. She didn't deny that caregivers needed support. She didn't deny that they suffered. She knew that John suffered. But what about me? She remembered the business card of the social worker at Mass General Hospital. She found it and dialed the number. Denise Daddario. Hi, Denise. This is Alice Howland. I'm a patient of Dr. Davis, and he gave me your card. I'm 51, and I was diagnosed with early-onset Alzheimer's almost a year ago. I was wondering, does MGH run any sort of support group for people with Alzheimer's? No, unfortunately we don't. We have a support group, but it's only for caregivers. Most of our patients with Alzheimer's wouldn't be capable of participating in that kind of forum. But some would. Yes, but I'm afraid we don't have the numbers to justify the resources it would take to get that kind of group up and running. What kinds of resources? Well, with our caregiver support group, about 12 to 15 people meet every week for a couple of hours. We have a room reserved, coffee, pastries, a couple of people on staff who act as facilitators, and a guest speaker once a month. What about just an empty room where people with early-onset dementia can meet and talk about what we're experiencing? I can bring the coffee and jelly donuts, for God's sake. We'd need someone on staff at the hospital to oversee it, and we unfortunately don't have anyone available right now. How about one of the two facilitators from your caregiver support group? Can you give me the contact information for the patients you know of with early-onset dementia so I can try to organize something on my own? I'm afraid I can't give out that information. Would you like to make an appointment to come in and talk with me? I have an opening at 10 in the morning on Friday, December 17th. No thanks. A noise at the front door woke her from her nap on the couch. The house was cold and dark. The front door squeaked as it opened. Sorry, I'm late. Alice rose and walked to the hallway. Anna stood there with a big brown paper bag in one hand and a jumbled pile of mail in the other. She was standing on the hole. Mom, all the lights are off in here. Were you sleeping? You shouldn't be napping this late in the day. You'll never sleep tonight. Alice walked over to her and crouched down. She put her hand on the hole. Only it wasn't empty space, she felt. She ran her fingers over the looped wool of a black rug. Her black hallway rug. It had been there for years. She smacked it with her open hand so hard the sound she made echoed. Mom, what are you doing? Her hand stung. She was too tired to endure the humiliating answer to Anna's question, and an overpowering peanut smell coming from the bag disgusted her. Leave me alone. Mom, it's okay. Let's go in the kitchen and have dinner. Anna put the mail down and reached for her mother's hand, the hand that stung. Alice flung it away from her and screamed. Leave me alone! Get out of my house! I hate you! I don't want you here! Her words hit Anna's face harder than if she'd slapped her. Through the tears that streamed down it, Anna's expression clenched into calm resolve. I brought dinner, I'm starving, and I'm staying. I'm going into the kitchen to eat, and then I'm going to bed. Alice stood in the hallway alone, fury and fight raging madly through her veins. She opened the door and began pulling at the rug. She yanked with all her strength and was knocked down. She got up and pulled and twisted and wrestled it until it was entirely outside. Then she kicked and screamed wildly at it until it limped down the front steps and lay lifeless on the sidewalk. Alice, answer the following questions. 1. What month is it? 2. Where do you live? 3. Where is your office? 4. When is Anna's birthday? 5. How many children do you have? If you have trouble answering any of these, go to the file named Butterfly on your computer and follow the instructions there immediately. November, Cambridge, Harvard, September, 3. December 2004. Dan's thesis numbered 142 pages, not including references. Alice hadn't read anything that long in a long time. She sat on the couch with Dan's words in her lap, a red pen balanced on her right ear, and a pink highlighter in her right hand. She used the red pen for editing and the pink highlighter for keeping track of what she'd already read. She highlighted anything that struck her as important, so when she needed to backtrack, she could limit her rereading to the colored words. She became hopelessly stalled on page 26, which was saturated in pink. Her brain felt overwhelmed and begged her for rest. She imagined the pink words on the page transforming into sticky pink cotton candy in her head. The more she read, the more she needed to highlight to understand and remember what she was reading. The more she highlighted, the more her head became packed with pink woolly sugar, clogging and muffling the circuits in her brain that were needed to understand and remember what she was reading. By page 26, she understood nothing. Beep, beep. She tossed Dan's thesis onto the coffee table and went to the computer in the study. She found one new email in her inbox from Denise Daddario. Dear Alice, I've shared your idea for an early-stage dementia support group with the other early onsetters here in our unit and with the folks at Brigham and Women's Hospital. I've heard back from 3 people who are local and very interested in this idea. They've given me permission to give you their names and contact information. See attachment. You might also want to contact the Mass Alzheimer's Association. They may know of others who'd want to meet with you. Keep me posted with how it goes, and let me know if I can provide you with any other information or advice. I'm sorry we couldn't formally do more for you here. Good luck, Denise Daddario. She opened the attachment. Mary Johnson, age 57, frontotemporal lobe dementia. Kathy Roberts, age 48, early onset Alzheimer's disease. Dan Sullivan, age 53, early onset Alzheimer's disease. There they were, her new colleagues. She read their names over and over. Mary, Kathy, and Dan. Mary, Kathy, and Dan. She began to feel the kind of wondrous excitement mixed with barely suppressed dread she'd experienced in the weeks before her first days of kindergarten, college, and graduate school. What did they look like? Were they still working? How long had they been living with their diagnoses? Were their symptoms the same, milder, or worse? Were they anything like her? What if I'm much further along than they are? Dear Mary, Kathy, and Dan, my name is Alice Howland. I am 51 years old and was diagnosed with early-onset Alzheimer's disease last year. I was a psychology professor at Harvard University for 25 years, but essentially failed out of my position due to my symptoms this September. Now I'm home and feeling really alone in this. I called Denise Daddario at MGH for information on an early-stage dementia support group. They only have one for caregivers, nothing for us. But she gave me your names. I'd like to invite you all to my house for tea, coffee, and conversation this Sunday, December 5th, at 2 o'clock. Your caregivers are welcome to come and stay if you'd like. Attached are my address and directions. I'm looking forward to meeting you. Alice. Mary, Kathy, and Dan. Mary, Kathy, and Dan. Dan. Dan's thesis. He's waiting for my edits. She returned to the living room couch and opened Dan's thesis to page 26. The pink rushed into her head. Her head ached. She wondered if anyone had replied yet. She abandoned Dan's thingy before she even finished the thought. She clicked on her inbox. Nothing new. Beep, beep. She picked up the phone. Hello? Dial tone. She'd hoped it was Mary, Kathy, or Dan. Dan. Dan's thesis. Back on the couch, she looked poised and active with the highlighter in her hand, but her eyes weren't focused on the letters on the page. Instead, she daydreamed. Could Mary, Kathy, and Dan still read 26 pages and understand and remember all that they read? What if I'm the only one who thinks the hallway rug could be a hole? What if she was the only one declining? She could feel herself declining. She could feel herself slipping into that demented hole, alone. I'm alone, I'm alone, I'm alone, she moaned, sinking further into the truth of her lonely hole each time she heard her own voice say the words. Beep, beep. The doorbell snapped her out of it. Were they here? Had she invited them over today? Just a minute. She rubbed her eyes with her sleeves, combed her fingers through her matted hair as she walked, took a deep breath, and opened the door. There was no one there. Auditory and visual hallucinations were realities for about half of people with Alzheimer's disease, but so far she hadn't experienced any. Or maybe she had. When she was alone, there wasn't any clear way of knowing whether what she'd experienced was reality or her reality with Alzheimer's. It wasn't as if her disorientations, confabulations, delusions, and all other demented thingies were highlighted in fluorescent pink, unmistakably distinguishable from what was normal, actual, and correct. From her perspective, she simply couldn't tell the difference. The rug was a hole. That noise was the doorbell. She checked her inbox again. One new email. Hi, Mom. How are you? Did you go to the lunch seminar yesterday? Did you run? My class was great, as usual. I had another audition today for a bank commercial. We'll see. How's Dad doing? Is he home this week? I know last month was hard. Hang in there. I'll be home soon. Love, Lydia. Beep, beep. She picked up the phone. Hello? Dial tone. She opened the top file cabinet drawer, dropped the phone inside, heard it hit the metal bottom beneath hundreds of hanging reprints, and slid the drawer shut. Wait, maybe it's my cell phone. Cell phone, cell phone, cell phone, she chanted aloud as she roamed the house, trying to keep the goal of her search present. She checked everywhere but couldn't find it. Then she figured out that she needed to be looking for her baby blue bag. She changed the chant. Blue bag, blue bag, blue bag. She found it on the kitchen counter, her cell phone inside, but off. Maybe the noise was someone's car alarm, locking or unlocking outside. She resumed her position on the couch and opened Dan's thesis to page 26. Hello? Asked a man's voice. Alice looked up, eyes wide, and listened, as if she'd just been summoned by a ghost. Alice? Asked the disembodied voice. Yes? Alice, are you ready to go? John appeared in the threshold of the living room looking expectant. She was relieved, but needed more information. Let's go. We're meeting Bob and Sarah for dinner, and we're already a little late. Dinner. She just realized she was starving. She didn't remember eating any food today. Maybe that was why she couldn't read Dan's thesis. Maybe she just needed some food. But the thought of dinner and conversation in a loud restaurant drained her further. I don't want to go to dinner. I'm having a hard day. I had a hard day, too. Let's go have a nice dinner together. You go. I just want to be home. Come on, it'll be fun. We didn't go to Eric's party. It'll be good for you to get out, and I know they'd like to see you. No, they wouldn't. They'll be relieved that I'm not there. I'm a cotton candy pink elephant in the room. I make everyone uncomfortable. I turn dinner into a crazy circus act, everyone juggling their nervous pity and forced smiles with their cocktail glasses, forks, and knives. I don't want to go. Tell them I'm sorry, but I wasn't feeling up to it. Beep, beep. She saw John hear the noise, too, and she followed him into the kitchen. He popped open the microwave oven door and pulled out a mug. This is freezing cold. Do you want me to reheat it? She must have made tea that morning, and she'd forgotten to drink it. Then she must have put it in the microwave to reheat it and left it there. No thanks. All right, Bob and Sarah are probably already there waiting. Are you sure you don't want to come? I'm sure. I won't stay long. He kissed her and then left without her. She stood in the kitchen where he left her for a long time, holding the mug of cold tea in her hands. She was on her way to bed, and John still hadn't returned from dinner. The blue computer light glowing in the study caught her attention before she turned to go upstairs. She went in and checked her inbox, more out of habit than out of sincere curiosity. There they were. Dear Alice, my name is Mary Johnson. I'm 57 and was diagnosed with FTD 5 years ago. I live on the North Shore, so not too far from you. This is such a wonderful idea. I'd love to come. My husband Barry will drive me. I'm not sure if he'll want to stay. We've both taken an early retirement and we're both home all the time. I think he'd like a break from me. See you soon. Mary. Hi, Alice. I'm Dan Sullivan, 53 years old, diagnosed with EOAD 3 years ago. It runs in my family. My mother, 2 uncles, and 1 of my aunts had it, and 4 of my cousins do. So I saw this coming and have been living with it in the family since I was a kid. Funny, didn't make the diagnosis or living with it now any easier. My wife knows where you live, not far from MGH, near Harvard. My daughter went to Harvard. I pray every day that she doesn't get this. Dan. Hi, Alice. Thank you for your email and invitation. I was diagnosed with EOAD 1 year ago, like you. It was almost a relief. I thought I was going crazy. I was getting lost in conversations, having trouble finishing my own sentences, forgetting my way home, couldn't understand the checkbook anymore, was making mistakes with the kids' schedules. I have a 15-year-old daughter and a 13-year-old son. I was only 46 when the symptoms started, so of course no one ever thought it could be Alzheimer's. I think the medications help a lot. I'm on Aricept and Namenda. I have good days and bad. On the good, people and even my family use it as an excuse to think I'm perfectly fine, even making this up. I'm not that desperate for attention. Then a bad day hits, and I can't think of words or concentrate, and I can't multitask at all. I feel lonely, too. I can't wait to meet you. Kathy Roberts. P.S. Do you know about the Dementia Advocacy and Support Network International? Go to their website, www.dasninternational.org. It's a wonderful site for people like us in early stages and with early onset to talk, vent, get support, and share information. There they were, and they were coming. Mary, Kathy, and Dan removed their coats and found seats in the living room. Their spouses kept their coats on, bid them a reluctant goodbye, and left with John for coffee at Jerry's. Mary had chin-length blonde hair and round, chocolate-brown eyes behind a pair of dark-rimmed glasses. Kathy had a smart, pleasing face and eyes that smiled before her mouth did. Alice liked her immediately. Dan had a thick mustache, a balding head, and a stocky build. They could have been professors visiting from out of town, members of a book club, or old friends. "Would anyone like something to think?" asked Alice. They stared at her and at one another, disinclined to answer. Were they all too shy or polite to be the first to speak up? "Alice, did you mean drink?" asked Kathy. "Yes, what did I say?" "You said think." Alice's face flushed. Word substitution wasn't the first impression she'd wanted to make. "I'd actually like a cup of thanks. Mine's been close to empty for days. I could use a refill," said Dan. They laughed, and it connected them instantly. She brought in the coffee and tea as Mary was telling her story. "I was a real estate agent for 22 years. I suddenly started forgetting appointments, meetings, open houses. I showed up to houses with no keys. I got lost on my way to show a property in a neighborhood I'd known forever, with the client in the car with me. I drove around for 45 minutes when it should have taken less than 10. I can only imagine what she was thinking. I started getting angry easily and blowing up at the other agents in the office. I'd always been so easygoing and well-liked, and suddenly I was becoming known for my short fuse. I was ruining my reputation. My reputation was everything. My doctor put me on an antidepressant, and when that one didn't work, he put me on another and another. For a long time, I just thought I was overtired and multitasking too much, said Kathy. I was working part-time as a pharmacist, raising two kids, running the house, running around from one thing to the next like a chicken with my head cut off. I was only 46, so it never occurred to me that I might have dementia. Then one day at work, I couldn't figure out the names of the drugs, and I didn't know how to measure out 10 milliliters. Right then, I realized I was capable of giving someone the wrong amount of drug, or even the wrong drug. Basically, I was capable of accidentally killing someone. So I took off my lab coat, went home early, and never went back. I was devastated. I thought I was going crazy. "How about you, Dan? What were the first things you noticed?" asked Mary. "I used to be really handy around the house. Then one day, I couldn't figure out how to fix the things I'd always been able to fix. I always kept my workshop tidy, everything in its place. Now it's a total mess. I accused my friends of borrowing my tools and messing up the place and not returning them when I couldn't find them. But it was always me. I was a firefighter. I started forgetting the names of the guys on the force. I couldn't finish my own sentences. I forgot how to make a cup of coffee. I'd seen the same things with my mom when I was a teenager. She had early onset AD too. They shared stories of their earliest symptoms, their struggles to get a correct diagnosis, their strategies for coping and living with dementia. They nodded and laughed and cried over stories of lost keys, lost thoughts, and lost life dreams. Alice felt unedited and truly heard. She felt normal. "Alice, is your husband still working?" asked Mary. "Yes. He's been buried in his research and teaching this semester. He's been traveling a lot. It's been hard. But we both have a sabbatical year next year. So I just have to hold on and get to the end of next semester, and we'll be able to be home together for a whole year." "You can make it. You're almost there," said Kathy. "Just a few more months." Anna sent Lydia into the kitchen to make the white chocolate bread pudding. Noticeably pregnant now and no longer nauseated, Anna seemed to eat constantly, as if on a mission to make up for calories lost during the months of morning sickness. "I have some news," said John. "I've been offered the position of chairman at the Cancer Biology and Genetics Program at Sloan Kettering." "Where's that?" asked Anna through a mouthful of chocolate-covered cranberries. "New York City." No one said a word. Dean Martin belted out "A Marshmallow World" on the stereo. "Well, you're not actually entertaining the idea of taking it, are you?" asked Anna. "I am. I've been down there several times this fall, and it's a perfect position for me." "But what about Mom?" asked Anna. "She's not working anymore, and she rarely goes to campus at all." "But she needs to be here," said Anna. "No, she doesn't. She'll be with me." "Oh, please. I come over at night so you can work late, and I sleep over whenever you're out of town, and Tom comes when he can on the weekends," said Anna. "We're not here all the time, but..." "That's right, you're not here all the time. You don't see how bad it's getting. She pretends to know a lot more than she does. You think she's going to appreciate that we're in Cambridge a year from now? She doesn't recognize where she is now when we're 3 blocks away. We could very well be in New York City, and I could tell her it's Harvard Square, and she wouldn't know the difference." "Yes, she would, Dad," said Tom. "Don't say that." "Well, we wouldn't move before September. It's a long ways off." "It doesn't matter when it is. She needs to stay here. She'll go downhill fast if you move away," said Anna. "I agree," said Tom. They talked about her as if she weren't sitting in the wing chair, a few feet away. They talked about her in front of her as if she were dead.